Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
Welcome to the DMZ, everyone. A very special Thanksgiving episode of the DMZ.
Although, I don't think we're giving thanks to anything. I have no plans to thank anybody today.
Well, you were not in a thankful mood. You were in a vengeful mood.
That's true.
Because your great liberal lion, Woodrow Wilson, has come under attack by the PC left on college campuses.
I did an interview with Carl Cannon. I wrote the piece. I wrote my defense of Woodrow Wilson for Real Clear Politics yesterday, and he actually did a video interview with me afterwards. And so right away, he wants me to, malign the PC left broadly.
As the guy who stood up to the radicals who wanted single sex bathrooms at Oberlin, I think you still have the scars on your back.
Did I ever talk about that on air? I don't know if I ever mentioned that on air.
I think I just outed you as a champion of conservatism, battling the radical campus leftists for back in the 1960s, amazingly.
Let me just stress that was not a transgender bathroom debate.
Yes,
so don't lump me into that crowd.
I'm just teasing, but I am. We'll get into that sometime. But I do want to know about the Woodrow Wilson, because I mean these are not young Republicans who were out to get the liberal fascist Woodrow Wilson.
I think this is confusing to the right. I don't think they know which way to go on this one.
Right, it is confusing. It's like on one hand, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, but on the other hand, it's a great example to point out, PC run amok. Which way do we go? And I think this is part of the reason why it's one of the reasons this story's been so weird, is that it kind of has strange bedfellows.
Right. Well, let me just say, I don't have antagonism towards the students here. In my opinion, students will be students. You're away from home for the first time. You want to get into activism. It's very natural to want to fight the big issues like racism and war. And you look for opportunities in your neighborhood to make a dent in these big subjects. So you see a symbolic example of Woodrow Wilson. If you're at Princeton, you go after Woodrow Wilson.
It's like rebels without a cause is what you're...
Well, it's a cause. I mean, I would argue that it's not the right target for the cause. But, I'm not going to tell a student, what to do or not do. The adults in the picture, for the Princeton University president to validate, and then let me back up here. I mean, there's bad history being circulated here. It's complicated because there's obviously elements of truth to the narrative. It is indisputable. It's just a plain fact that Woodrow Wilson resegregated the federal workforce. I mean, that is the worst thing he did on race, by far. And it had, profoundly negative consequences. It harmed the black middle class of Washington, D.C. There's a piece in the New York Times today, a person talking about how it ruined the economic standing of his grandfather. There's another piece in Politico earlier, or maybe late last week, about how it fed a horrible race riot that began by violence by whites that blacks responded to and many died. It was called the Red Summer 1919. So it's not like there isn't a bad story to tell about Wilson on race. But number one, there's much more to Wilson than just that. He has probably one of the hugest sweeps of historical consequence of almost any president, like, love him or hate him. The guy had left a legacy that we are still, that America it's still with us today. I mean, it's not just theoretical. He played a pivotal role. He was a convert on women's suffrage. He played a pivotal role in the amendments passage. He implemented the first federal progressive income tax. He created the key antitrust legislation, giving the federal government the power to prevent monopolies and block corporate mergers. And internationally, you know, he basically made America a global power. You know, a different president would have not chosen, not even just not to enter World War I militarily, but not even want to get involved in peace negotiations and play a honest broker role, which is what Wilson's initial inclination was to do. He had a fight with William James Bryan, who was the first Secretary of State. And Bryan was more of the anti-imperialist, isolationist Democrat. And when Wilson, in the first term, was embarking on military preparedness, essentially preparing for America to play a role internationally, whether or not it would come to war, Bryan quit the administration and went on the stump to try to stop Wilson. Wilson, essentially, in beating Bryan, Bryan was the three-time Democratic nominee, kind of the soul of the party for a long time, and Wilson essentially wrested control of the party from Bryan in that fight, turning the Democratic Party into an internationalist party, which it has been ever since. So, of course, there's the League of Nations failure, which people talk about as an example of a bad part of Wilson's record, but that vision of an international peacemaking body was eventually realized by FDR and Truman, and that's not disconnected to Wilson. I mean, FDR was in Wilson's administration, had a portrait of Wilson in the White House. He was directly trying to implement what Wilson wanted to do, and Truman, unbeknownst to FDR, was also a Wilson disciple. And when FDR died, the first thing Truman did was, we have to go forth with the UN conference, because he very much internalized what Wilson wanted when Truman was in the trenches of World War I. So, and the UN played a massive role in, we don't have world wars anymore. The UN had a major role in the decolonization of much of the world and the spread of democracy.
I just want to recap. World War I was started when Turkey shot down a Russian airplane that had invaded airspace. I know this is going to be an evergreen episode. We don't know when this is going to air, but I just thought I would
I mean, obviously we can't predict what's going to happen with Turkey and Russia right now, but that is the kind of thing that 100 years ago led to a world war. And now that we have international peacemaking bodies, those types of incidents generally don't lead to world wars. They are resolved in more limited fashion. And again, that all goes back to Wilson. So to simply define Wilson as nothing but a racist.
So Bill, you've made a very good point that Wilson's legacy is broad and important to the American history and the American experience. It would be wrong to judge him on one aspect of his history. But you're not merely claiming that people are doing that. You're also claiming that they're actually getting history wrong. Right. Who and what have they gotten wrong?
I mean, the biggest thing, and I've seen this repeated multiple times in just the past week, was that Wilson was a defender of the KKK. And that is just simply factually wrong.
Has this been mainstream big outlets who have made this assertion?
This was strongly insinuated in the New York Times in their coverage of this flap on Monday. You know, they quote the cherry pick quotes that make it sound like he's a defender of the KKK and offered no counter argument. There is a piece in Vox by Dylan Matthews, and I had a very annoying exchange with him on Twitter yesterday over this. But he wrote a piece saying Woodrow Wilson was extremely racist and not just for his time. And that is, I mean, that broader question is also factually wrong, but a lot of it hinges upon the KKK argument. And
right. Well, this goes to a larger concern, I think, that we should have, and I think that conservatives definitely have, which is to say, should we be judging people by our people who lived in a different era by our standards? And if so, who can we celebrate? I mean, because everybody held standards that we might, you know, everybody 50 years ago, virtually everybody held standards that we might view to be at least politically incorrect today. And if you go back far enough, I mean, you could certainly exclude all of the founding fathers, probably. You know, so this is like a big philosophical debate.
But that's why the KKK thing is so important here, because that is an argument used to suggest that Wilson was worse than the national standard of the time. That he fits the depiction of a monster, and should be treated as an historical pariah. Otherwise, you would just say, well, he's like Washington and Jefferson, and therefore we won't rub his name off of buildings. If he's worse than that, then you have more of an argument to do so. And that's why I feel it's, well, before I get into the Prince and President here, let me just lay out the facts here. The KKK thing comes from a five-volume series he wrote called The History of the American People, which was published in 1902. And the final volume, it gets into Reconstruction. Now, Wilson was born in the South, and like most white Southerners, was extremely bitter towards post-Civil War Reconstruction policies. They thought it was unfair retribution to them. It thought it was wrong to have so quickly given African Americans full rights. And Wilson was unhappy about it. And to that end, you know, Wilson was most certainly wrong. I mean, there's no defense of that. So there's about five pages or so about the KKK in the context of the Reconstruction section. And the beginning of that section is the suggestion that the KKK had legitimate grievance because of these abominable Reconstruction policies. And they were simply standing up for, the good white South. But at the end of the KKK section, he very clearly says that that brutal crimes were committed, people were murdered, the innocent were harmed along with the guilty, and society was infinitely more disturbed than defended. I mean, that's Wilson's words. That's his end conclusion. But you're seeing, particularly in the Vox piece and in the New York Times too, you cherry pick certain turns of phrase where he says a great Ku Klux Klan. That's his initial description of it. In the context, he's not saying the Ku Klux Klan was great and we should love them. He's saying that it was large and impactful. The end conclusion is that they were horrible. So
all right, let me just stop you there. Two quick questions. Number one, three questions actually. number one, are you the only person who has picked this up, or are there other historians who have picked it up? And then the other question would be, when you confront people on Twitter with this evidence, how do they respond, and how can they deny this?
I mean, well, just to your latter point, I mean, I had a back and forth with Dylan Matthews at Vox on this very point, and it's like talking to a wall. He just spits back the cherry-picked phrases and just ignores. I mean, I put the full quote in the piece. It's not like... And I link to the primary source document on the Library of Congress website. So you can't find it.
Is anybody else backing you up or making these same points? Or are you essentially the only one pointing this out?
Well, I got to tell you, I literally have not seen anybody else make this point. Maybe somebody has. I have not seen it. I've seen other people in recent days defend the notion of Wilson remaining on the name of buildings. But with the general acknowledgement that he was a racist, and making your point that if we expunge Wilson, you got to expunge everybody, some people have also made the case that look, he did all these other good things. We can't set up a guy just based on this one aspect. There have been two major biographies that came out about Wilson in the past few years. One is by John Milton Cooper, and another is by A. Scott Berg, and they are both, generally favorable to Wilson at the end of the day. So perhaps you don't want to just lean on them for your Wilson histories. You want to find some more negative stuff, have a balanced view, go right ahead. But both Berg and Cooper explored Wilson race in great depth. They both came to the similar conclusion that he was more indifferent about race than actively hateful. They don't excuse. Neither one excuses him. They both criticize him for segregation. They criticize him for not being open minded enough to change his views the way he did on women's suffrage. He was a convert to women's suffrage, but they push back against the notion of the crude caricature that he was a classic, Southern race.
So when this controversy erupted and students, were wanting to basically whitewash, for lack of a better word, they wanted to throw Woodrow Wilson down the memory hole. When that happened, had you read so much history that you intuitively or instantly knew that they were wrong, or did you have to go back and read and investigate to see whether or not Wilson actually had, in fact, been praised the KKK?
This came up because I had read the Cooper book, and we actually talked about the Cooper book on a show way back when. And somebody in the comment threads was bringing up the race question and the KKK stuff. And I actually could not find the KKK pushback in the Cooper book because it's so ridiculous, it wasn't necessary to bring that up. I mean, that's still the common Wilson critique is based on the segregation policies. So it's so beyond the pale that it wasn't necessary for Cooper to go through the particulars. I saw it in the thread, I was like, well, that's weird. I feel like that would have come up in the book if that was true.
The reason I bring it up just, is because as someone who writes myself, and I think it's interesting to note like where good ideas come from and how columnists and opinion leaders, as you are, Bill, are able to have stuff to write about. And part of the job, I think, is reading history and knowing stuff so that when you can't predict what's going to come up, but when something like this comes up, you had a sense. You didn't know exactly the details, but right. As soon as the story came up, you like something just doesn't smell right about this. Right.
That's exactly how it was. And then I went and actually read that section of Wilson's book, and I was like, wait a second, I think I put that in the blogging it started way back when. And so to now see it being repeated over and over, I saw a Washington Post column by someone again defending Wilson, defending keeping his name in the buildings, that just sort of says as a matter of fact assertion, well, we defended the KKK. It's gotten that internalized. So I think we have a serious problem where bad history is being absorbed by the public.
Yeah.
And so to go back to Princeton now. So for the Princeton president so what has happened here, there was a sit-in. They had demands to take Wilson's name off of buildings and remove a mural from one of the from I think maybe it's a dining hall. And so the president said, "I will endorse removing the mural from the wall." He's not the final decision on that, but he said he would endorse it and push for it. And he would initiate conversations with the trustees over removing his name off of other buildings, including, an entire School of International Relations that is at Princeton. it's not fait accompli that his name's going to get scribbled all together. It's probably more likely that it's not. But by putting his thumb on the scale and saying, I agree we should at least take down the mural, he is already validating this distortive narrative, opposed to
the other thing too, Bill. I mean, and this goes without saying, but the one of the real problems here is perception is reality. And 25 years from now, somebody can write a revisionist history of Woodrow Wilson, and they'll Google him, and they'll find that Vox and the New York Times suggested that he was fond of the KKK, and therefore it becomes truth.
Right.
That's really scary and dangerous.
Right.
How that works. I mean, there'll be an argument at a bar 20 years from now, and somebody will prove that Woodrow Wilson was a fan of the KKK by Googling this Vox story. I mean, it's possible. So it's just, and the other thing that I'll bring up is that these are ostensibly serious mainstream media outlets that you know, these are not fringy sites on the right or the left, and these are not, you know, I mean, these are sites that, that have a certain imprimatur that you ought to be able to trust. And it makes me wonder, if they're getting it wrong on this bill, how much other stuff have they gotten wrong over the years that we didn't catch them on?
I mean, you know, in the case of the New York Times, you know, it's not quite rising to the level of correction because they didn't outright say it. They said, you know, some people say based on these quotes, and just didn't give you the alternative view.
It's a sin of omission in that case.
Exactly. The other thing was a Washington Post column, and maybe the fact checkers didn't do the same level of scrubbing on that that they might do for a news piece. In the case of Vox, now Vox is not of the same level of the Times and the Post, excuse me, but the whole reason of being a Vox is to be an explainer site, right? that's their right. job. And you're now actively not explaining things properly. Now, there's one of the.
I hate to derail here, but I mean, like, it strikes me that this is like an inherent problem when you have people. I don't know this guy that wrote this piece, but okay, so you're asking a guy who's 25, 30, 35, 40, I don't know, to be like an expert on everything and to weigh in and to set the record straight on every little thing. And he's probably got to produce X number of pieces a day or a week or whatever. And the truth is that this, like, you should bring in like a Woodrow Wilson expert to weigh in on this.
Right.
And so many of these stories, people, you know, and I mean, you know, I'm not a Woodrow Wilson expert. I don't think you would consider yourself one either, although you probably read a lot more about Wilson than some of the so-called experts. But my point is that, like, in a way, this sort of error and the consequences are huge, potentially, but it's almost destined to happen by virtue of the way that these sites operate. And no matter how smart and how diligent you are, the need to put out that much content that quickly will inevitably lead to these sort of problems.
Now, I want to bring up one other point of disagreement I have with the Matthews Vox column, because I just want to get the facts laid out here properly in some capacity. So one of the things that comes up with Wilson a lot is that he endorsed the film Birth of a Nation. And as for folks, I mean, that was a pro-KKK film and actually was used for KKK recruitment in the early 20th century. Now, what is indisputable is that he screened Birth of the Nation at the White House. That is true. And the movie was based on a book called The Klansman by a guy named Thomas Dixon. And Dixon was an old friend of Wilson's from their college days. Where it gets disputed is what did Wilson say about the film after he saw it? And so what you're seeing now in a lot of this coverage is that Wilson praised the film as teaching history with lightning or writing history with lightning. The quotes get mangled. And there's a version of the quote that is, you know, and the sad thing about it is that's also terribly true. Now, that longer form of the quote was pointed out in the Cooper book, the Berg book. There's also another book called World Statesman by Kendrick Clements in the footnotes they mentioned. That quote didn't get published until 1937, 22 years after this screening. And there's no evidence that Wilson ever said it at the time. There were lots of protests around the film led by the NAACP, which was in its early years. Wilson made a formal statement saying that he had no idea what the film was about before he saw it and said nothing, had no appropriation of it. I think it was the words that he used. That's definitive. He said that he actively refused to endorse it when under pressure. Now, so I point in my piece that this is almost certainly apocryphal because there's no contemporary evidence of him saying this. Matthews says the opposite in his piece. And he pushes back at me on Twitter saying, here's the evidence of the contemporary accounts. You're wrong. And he points to an academic paper that was published a few years ago, which is behind a paywall. So I say, well, I'm sorry, I can't access this. You know, I wasn't aware of it. I'd like to see it. But I can tell you what Berg and Cooper and Clements say. And he trash talks back and says, well, that's what you get by reading popular histories and not reading the scholarly literature. So now he's the expert, and I'm the dilettante. And so, but he sends me a PDF of it, and I read it. And, I mean, the academic there, I think his last name was Ben Bao. I think it's Mark Ben Bao. He makes a case that D.W. Griffith, who was the director of Birth of a Nation, said on his promotional tour that an eminent person said this is like writing history with lightning. He did not use Wilson's name. There is an inference there, and the author makes the case that, well, he must have been talking about Wilson. But even if that's the case, doesn't mean that Griffith was on the level. And there's nothing else out there that really backs that up. And it also, again, doesn't, even if he made, and what Griffin said did not have that second part of the clause, that it's also terribly true. You know, you could comment in theory, that's like writing history with lightning. Doesn't mean that you love the film. Just means that you are, you know, shocked by what cinema does, because you haven't seen a movie before, you know. So there's all sorts of ways that you could interpret that, whether Wilson said it or not, and what the meaning of it was.
Tell me if you would. That film, Birth of a Nation, how was it at the time? How was it received? And what was its, putting aside its message, what was its sort of cinematic importance?
It was a massive deal at the time. I mean, it was an extremely polarizing event, and there was tons of protests. I mean, it was outright an outright attempt at revisionist history to whitewash what happened post Civil War.
And so it was controversial at the time.
Absolutely, absolutely. Okay. No, it was a huge deal. I mean, it put Wilson in a bind, and he had some regret for showing it. I mean, that's not an exoneration of his broader record on race, but like, I mean, but it speaks to, he just didn't really want to deal with it. I mean, his thrust was, how do I not have to deal with this stuff? How do I avoid having controversies and frictions? He had a misguided sense that segregating the workforce was going to reduce friction between the races. This was a common theme at the time that
right.
was
all well, and let me just say, I don't want to score any political points here, but I do think it's worth noting that it was Wilsonian progressives that believed in segregation originally, and the cities. You go back and you look at during the rioting in Baltimore, there was some pretty good writing, I think, from mostly liberal sites, pointing out that the segregation of cities in many cases was the result of progressive policies that specifically tried to do that. I mean, and presumably they had, they believed that there was that something positive would come out of this, no matter how misguided that was.
Yeah. I mean, the new deal was not pure on race by any stretch. Teddy Roosevelt. I mean, Teddy Roosevelt is sort of an interesting character. I mean, he wasn't a Democrat, but he was a progressive Republican, and he started his presidency by inviting Booker T. Washington to the White House, and that was scandalous in the White South, and a lot of hope amongst blacks because he had that symbolic gesture. But then later in his presidency, there was rioting in Brownsville, Texas, involving blacks in the military, and Teddy blamed the blacks, and that soured his relationship with blacks at the time. And then when Teddy ran for president in 1912, after he was president, and the question arose, well, what role will you give blacks in your new progressive party? He made the decision to not allow Southern blacks to have a role in the progressive party. Northern blacks could, Southern blacks could not. And this was the trend. You go back to the Dylan Matthews piece. He was, well, Teddy Roosevelt and William Taft appointed more blacks than Wilson did. Therefore, Wilson was worse than the standards of the time. That ignores the trajectory, because Taft had already made the decision to stop appointing blacks to Southern government posts as a concession to white Southerners. He already turned the ship of government in that direction. Teddy Roosevelt then does a similar thing with the Progressive Party. Wilson gets elected, segregates the workforce. There's this whole notion that we need to make Southern whites happy by and keep them away from blacks. And so, obviously, that's wrong. It is a sorry chapter in America's history, and Wilson's role in that should be told accurately. And if your conclusion at the end of that is, you know what, that does outweigh everything else for me. Man, do I hate Wilson because of that. That's your call. I get that. But if you're the president of Princeton, your job is to teach. You know, right. You're supposed to add information, not subtract from it. If you want to put a giant exhibit on campus that lays all of this out, that would be fantastic. But to scrub him doesn't do that.
You know, I think most conservatives would say, yes, Woodrow Wilson was a horrible president, and he should not, and he should, you know, he should come down. But let's at least be honest about it. Let's get the facts right. And especially if you are from an Ivy League, revered, you know, august institution, or a respected media outlet. It's especially egregious that they're the most guilty here of doing this.
Well, I think I've been on my soapbox a lot for this show so far. You know,
do we end it and tape two separate episodes, or do we keep it?
Let's keep rolling. Let's keep rolling. Okay. We can ask blogging heads if they want to break up into two things or not. I want you to have your due, and I think we have time to give you your due, because this is a special Thanksgiving episode, as we said, Since there's not so much topical news for us to discuss right now, this is a perfect time to...
Well, there's topical news, but we don't know when this is going to air.
Right.
And so the topical news may not be so topical when this airs. So it's safer to stick with... I don't think Woodrow Wilson is going to come back to life and change his policies anytime soon. So we'll stick with the evergreen stories.
Let's go deep into your upcoming book.
Yeah.
Too Dumb to Fail. You want to pre-order it. You want to be the first one to get it.
Please.
And I want to give people reason to pre-order it by going
deep. Let me just give them a quick reason, which is not a good reason, but it is an interesting explainer you're not going to get anywhere else. So, I've never cared about anything like ratings or sales before, because my audience is generally opinion leaders, not the masses. But I don't think I'm going to ever win a Pulitzer Prize or a book award. So the one way that we could make this book pop and really get out of it, I think, what it deserves is the bestsellers list. You can't game the system. We saw what happens if you try to like buy bulk orders. They catch you. Number one. Number two, who's going to, I can't have my super PAC buy bulk orders of this book. What you need to do basically is you need to get somewhere 5 to 7,000, I don't know how many, copies sold within a single week. Now, the best way to make that happen is to get pre-orders going, right? So instead of having a week to do it, we've got 2 months to basically sell a lot of these copies. I have spent a couple years writing this bill. I think you will attest that it's damn good. So if you've not done it already, you can pre-order Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, wherever you get your books. And I just wanted to explain like why, aside from the fact that I think you're going to like it and that I think it makes a compelling argument that I mean, I don't think you're going to get anywhere else. This is why I'm, shamelessly hawking this book on our show every week.
And for those in the audience, I think this goes beyond, helping Matt, which is obviously, we all want to help you. Matt's a wonderful person. We also want to see him do well. But I think if you have been following Matt and you're coming from the right side of the pond and you know Matt's general critique of the Republican Party and want to see that be furthered and be part of the national conversation to the point where the Republican Party really accepts it.
I feel like this is one of those PBS things where we're pressuring people to make a donation or something.
Well, I'm saying what I think this means. If through your pre-orders you make this book a bestseller, you are going to potentially change the Republican Party.
Well, that's the key. That's the real goal, right? I mean, the real goal is to make a difference. I mean, there's no better honor as a writer. There's like no better reward than your something you wrote actually mattering. And we can force people to pay attention to my message by making a splash, essentially. I think, I mean, whether the book sells any copies or not, I think I'm right. I think I make valid, you know, valid arguments that are interesting and I think true. But if we want to drive this into the discussion, into the debate, and the book drops right before Iowa, that's the other good thing, the timing. I think there's a potential that this book could impact the race. And I do think that conservatism's at a crossroads. There is a way that leads toward, let's say, a Marco Rubio, Paul Ryan, Ronald Reagan, Jack Kemp direction, which I think is very positive in terms of conservatives winning the 21st century. And then there's a angry, populist, nativist direction, which we might say would be Donald Trump. And I think that is the wrong direction. And I think we could go down that road, sadly.
In all likelihood, Iowa is going to be, you know, peak dumbness in the Republican race. That's what that, you know, that's the home of Mike Huckabee and Rick Santorum, you know. So
yeah,
it's coming at just the right time for my perspective. But
and then New Hampshire's a week later. So,
but New Hampshire's often a corrective. Yeah, I don't. You want to be before Iowa?
Yeah, we are. We are. but the book's impact could, even if the book doesn't impact Iowa, and it may not, it may still make a difference going into New Hampshire and other states.
Well, I want to ask you, I wrote a book, you know, way back when, Wait, Don't Move to Canada, which was sort of a similar impetus. How do we fix the Democratic Party? How do we resurrect liberalism? This was back in 2006, maybe. I think most of the writing was in 2005. And so my impetus was right after John Kerry lost a race that a lot of liberals thought we were going to win because the economy wasn't great and Bush's numbers weren't great. And so that was a real gut punch when Kerry lost, and people were really reeling on the left. They didn't really know how can we fix this. And eventually, several books came out how to fix things, and mine was one of many. But that was sort of my impetus that, you know, not only was this feeling in the air that all is lost, but I thought that I had a certain background. Coming at a public relations background, I thought, not an activist background, and I thought that would be useful to talking about, okay, what kinds of principles and phrases and frames would gain the most traction and show there was a path ahead. Did you have a moment like that? Was there an epiphany where like things are really wrong here, and I have something unique to bring to the table to help fix it?
Well, I think it was really accumulation of things. I mean, I started writing maybe 5 years ago about how I saw maybe even longer. I mean, if you get 2010, right? That was about 5 years ago. I would say that was the year Christine O'Donnell, Sharon Angle, Sarah Palin started to kind of go rogue. I mean, that was around the time when I started to write that things I'm seeing in the Tea Party movement are not consistent with what I believe. It's as a conservative and how I am temperamentally as a conservative. And so that was really when it started. And I started writing columns. I was at AOL's Politics Daily, and they frankly were not very well received. There was a lot of pushback from fellow conservatives who thought that it was just frankly wrong of me to dare criticize Christine O'Donnell or Sharon Angle or some of the others. Thankfully, in the past 5 years, it's gotten better. I think that the book is now coming out at the time where I've learned more and when the audience is going to be more receptive. I mean, you know, Republicans have lost the popular vote in 5 out of the last 6 presidential elections. So that's part of, I think, why there's more receptivity to it. Interestingly, Bill, I want to bring up, this book, although it is an argument, it's also... it's divided into essentially 4 sections. The first section establishes that, in fact, conservatism was a thoughtful philosophy. So I go into a history from Aristotle to Edmund Burke to William F. Buckley. The second section talks about how groups that emerged to form the conservative coalition also sort of, you know, made it inexorably problematic. So you have the rise of evangelicals. I go back to the Scopes trial, the Scopes monkey trial. You know, the rise of the South becoming a part of the Republican coalition, which obviously helped electorally, but planted some seeds that we're now dealing with. You know, and then the third section deals with, frankly, the problems that we're facing today, the dumbing down of conservatism, the populist nativist stuff that we're dealing with. And then the final section is my recipe forward for success, it's something I call modernize, not moderate. But there's really there are a lot of books that people who follow current events and modern politics may not be terribly familiar with that really sort of helped inspire my thinking of this book. I'm going to hold a couple of them up. One is Anti-Intellectualism in American Life by Richard Hofstadter, which is kind of a classic political science book. This was written in 1963, but a lot of the ideas that I hash out are, you know, go back all the way back then. And in some cases, it's surprising how little things have changed. Another one is called Amusing Ourselves to Death by a guy named Neil Postman. This is also kind of a classic book. But when I deal with the dumbing down, not just of conservatism, but of politics today, and the TV age specifically having a lot to do with it, this book was really prescient, written in the 80s. And then, you know, I mentioned that I talked about evangelicalism. I am an evangelical. But I think this book says it all. It's called The Scandal of the Evangelical Mind by Mark A. Knoll. And he says the scandal of the evangelical mind is that there's not much of an evangelical mind. Other books that really helped influence me, I don't have it right here, but Craig Shirley's Rendezvous with Destiny about Reagan obviously helped me write about Reagan. This is a really good book. It's fairly new. Yuval Levin's The Great Debate about Edmund Burke and Thomas Paine. If you don't want to delve into, you know, reading heavy stuff like Reflections on the Revolution in France, but you want a good primer, Yuval Levin has done us a great service there. So I do want people to know this isn't just me spouting off and giving my opinion. I think that these books demonstrate that this is hopefully an intellectual pursuit, and it rests on history and a lot of interesting thinkers that have come before me.
Well, you were asking me before about how did I, you know, understand all the stuff about Wilson and what books did I read and how was that process? So for you, were these all books that you had read in college or you read as an adult, and because you just like reading 1960s era political science books, or were you working backwards? Like, I know something's not right here. Yeah. I know conservatism is more intellectual, but I don't know how. It's how do I work backwards and tie that together? Or is this just like, everyone in your conservative intellectual circles, like, these are the books we've all read. Everybody who's a real intellectual conservative walks through this canon, and that is how we become, that's how our minds are molded. How does that work for you?
Well, I think one of the interesting things is that the three main books that I brought up are really certainly not part of the conservative canon. The Hofstadter book, I actually read or was assigned to read, I probably didn't read much of it, in college, and Dr. Chase's, I guess, political science class at Shepherd College, now Shepherd University. The Neil Postman book, Amusing Ourselves to Death, John Ward, my friend and colleague, now at Yahoo, highly recommends that book. And it was incredibly prescient in terms of predicting how TV would change things. I would say that the dangerous thing here is that in a way I feel like one of those rock bands who their first album is amazing and then the sophomore slump sets in. You know, Hootie and the Blowfish probably spent 15 years writing Crack Rear View, you know, writing or, you know, going on tour, performing in bars. And then it's, you know, it's accumulation of their greatest hits, essentially. It becomes their first album. And then they write their second album in 6 months. And, you know, it's obviously not as good. So basically, this book is the accumulation of wisdom and knowledge that I've been gathering, it's really been my beat for some reason. It's a self-assigned beat. I've become fascinated with I could have written about anything or anybody. Nobody tells me really what I need to write about, but I've just been drawn to conservatism. I think it's at a crossroads now. I think that it needs constructive criticism. And that's the difference, by the way. There's going to be other people who come out with similar books in the weeks and months that follow. I would argue that one of the things that sets this book, Too Dumb to Fail, apart is that it's a conservative writing about how to save conservatism, and it's sincere advice coming from a sincere place. But it's really the fact – so first of all, it's just stuff that I've been interested in organically, and I've just sort of come across by virtue of writing columns and blog posts. The other thing I will say is that once you start writing a book, you will inevitably be forced – you will uncover something that leads you to something you didn't know, or questions will arise, or gaps in your thinking or your worldview doesn't quite make sense. And so no matter how prepared you are, how much research and reading you've done before you write the book – you're going to do a lot more once you start writing the book. It'll lead you to places you didn't even know exist. So even though I went into this book having essentially done, you know, having my writing at AOL and townhall.com and the Daily Caller and the Daily Beast, and it sort of having been like, I was basically getting paid for on-the-job training for writing this book, I still, once I started writing it, had to do all sorts of reading and research, because that is just the nature of writing a book.
Now, part of the canon that you talk about, I think, rests pretty heavily on Edmund Burke. Is that fair to say?
Yes, absolutely. And this is somewhat in dispute, because I would say that if you ask, you know, most conservative intellectuals who the founder of modern day conservatism is, you know, 7 or 8 out of 10 would probably say Burke, but not everyone agrees. In fact, Craig Shirley, my friend and a great author of books about Reagan, is not a big Burke fan, and actually thinks that you know, Locke perhaps should be the father of of modern day America. See, American conservatism is a different animal than European conservatism, and that's a big point of contention, I would say.
Well, I was struck by your so as people might know, I've read the book in many incarnations. I offer
yes.
My editing
Thank
advice,
you.
so I'm very familiar with it. And I was reading. There's plenty of parts of it that I don't agree with at all, as you might expect. But reading the Burke parts, you know, it felt to me like Burke was less of a conservative as we think of conservative today, but conservative in having kind of a caution, a pragmatism, a hesitancy,
prudence, wisdom, prudence.
Right.
These, yeah.
You know, he was sympathetic towards the American Revolution, but not toward the French Revolution. You know, that the French Revolution had excessively utopian ideals that were bound to undermine the whole project. And like that to me is a value and an insight that could be adopted by the left or the right. That there was something uniquely conservative. There was not something uniquely conservative about it. You could be very liberal and want to see government do lots of things and be tempered by a Burkean wisdom that trying to bite off more than you can chew is not going to work.
Right. I would say, I think you make a valid point that what we have, a lot of what passes for conservatism today is really reactionary or just the opposite of what Obama wants. That's the definition of conservative. And so I do think that there's a stark contrast between what Burkean conservatism is versus what we might call conservatism today. Having said that, I do think that there is a stark worldview. So, for example, you know, the essence of conservatism from Burke to Hayek would be this epistemological modesty, which is to suggest that the world is too complex for us to game out and for us to have, you mentioned like utopian schemes, these sort of fatal conceits. So, for example, the notion that you could have a comprehensive plan where you have universal health care, I think a Burkean conservative would conclude that that is a utopian scheme that is unwise and that doesn't factor in sort of human nature and the fact that that we can't really have a top-down plan that games out what might happen. So, so I think that, for example, and this is one example, we could go through many more, but I think that Burkean conservatism would, taking a modern issue, Obamacare, would oppose Obamacare, maybe for different reasons than today's Republican Party, but that would be the philosophical foundational reason that Burkean conservatives would oppose Obamacare.
Also a fan of Burke, Woodrow Wilson.
Interesting. Yeah. Yes. And I think John F. Kennedy as well, I think, helped, I think Kennedy's, I could be wrong about this. I think Kennedy's responsible for the sort of bastardization of a quote, allegedly Edmund Burke said, "All that is necessary for the triumph of evil is for good men to do nothing." In fact, Burke never actually said that. He said something like a paragraph that adds up to that. But I could be wrong. I believe it was Kennedy who injected that misquote into the public consciousness. And for that, we are grateful.
Now, another part of your book, which I think is, what you're basically doing in your book.
I'm sorry, Bill, let me just jump in real quick.
Sure.
I'm going to ask you a question because you've seen this you started looking at this over a year ago, over the course of many iterations. I'm of the opinion that this book got dramatically better throughout the process of editing. And it just amazes me as a guy who normally writes columns that I turn around in 24 or 48 hours to have this luxury of spending. In some cases, it was a challenge because things were changing. I mean, when I started writing this book, Donald Trump wasn't even talking about running for president. And obviously, he plays a large role in the book in terms of really representing what I'm against, sort of being the focus point of what this book advocates against. But tell me from your perspective, because you were like, I'm sort of like the father who every day I can't see the child growing because he's growing every day. But you would pop in every couple months and the kid must. How much did it change and how stark was that?
Oh, I think it is immeasurably better, and it I don't know how you feel, but it for those of us who got into political writing via blogging, which by definition is it lacks editing. The whole point of blogging is that you don't have that filter of editing. It's just your raw words and feelings. Having written with quote unquote freedom for so long and then have to be checked at so many points along the way and have your words be questioned and refined. It's a reminder that there is value to that process. You know, we don't want to have a media where we don't have editors anymore because getting those other perspectives, having professionals know proper, you know, turns of phrases and being able to tell you, you know what, your flow of argument, I'm not following it here. You know, we got to reshuffle these things. So it makes more sense. You know, I get this.
It was just so rewarding to be able to, like, number one, get the exact right word that might come to you a week later. Number two, so much people think about writing a book and they think, about sort of these sort of poetic, the poetry of it. But a lot of it is, I mean, there's a lot of things involved. What does the cover look like? Who blurbs the book? How do you promote it? But I think the one thing I really underestimated was sort of the strategy of laying out the book in a way that strategically made sense, where what comes first, what comes second, building an argument. That part is so important. It's unglamorous. But, you know, I had this epiphany. I wrote about it on Facebook. But right before I had to hand in the manuscript, which would be really the second draft, but it was a big, big deal. This was like one of the big moments. My wife and I went on a vacation. We went to Arizona. And I was having real problems. There were two major problems with the book. One was that the ending wimped out. The ending was not did not honor the book. The ending was not as good as the book. The second problem was that, you know, they talk about murder your darlings is something we talk about in the world of writing. And it means you might have a great idea, but if it doesn't fit the book, if it doesn't fit the narrative, you need to get rid of it. Well, I'd already murdered as many of my darlings as I was willing to murder. And there were parts in my book that my editor liked, didn't want to get rid of, but they didn't fit the narrative. It just wasn't working. And my wife and I, we went on this vacation. I climbed, I think it's called Pinnacle Peak in Scottsdale. And she let me talk for 2 hours up and down this mountain. It's 100 degrees. The sun's beating down on us. I'm talking the whole way up, the whole way down the mountain. And I had this aha moment, this epiphany hit me on how I could fix one of those problems. 5 minutes later, I had the second one. And I came back, spent 5 hours rewriting the sections, basically the book. And it answered all my problems, solved all the problems. And I think, Bill, I think I could have sat in my office in front of my computer for 5 years and it would not have hit me what I needed to do. I needed exercise. I was walking. I was in seeing things that I never see, mountains. I don't, there are any mountains around here. And just talking, not writing, but talking. And man, that was just almost like a spiritual thing, you know, that climbing up on Salisbury Hill type moment. Jesus, take the wheel. It was great.
Now, can you articulate what the change was, or does that give away the ending?
It would be boring. I mean, I'll tell you, but it won't make much sense. So for example, Bill, you know, there's a section in there where I go on a little bit of a riff about new urbanism, and you know. And it was in it. There was a chapter early on about the South and suburbia, and I had that's where the new urbanism section was in, and it seemed like a total non sequitur. And I ended up moving that to a later chapter where I talk about my, you know, modernize, not moderate. And I talk about how conservatism can win in the 21st century. And part of it is getting rid of these caricatures of what constitutes a Southerner. And it fit in much better there. I mean, this sounds so boring and pedestrian. It won't sound to anybody else like the aha moment. But in terms of reading the book, having it logically flow, that's just one of the things that made a huge, huge difference. The other thing was, you know, the book I mentioned earlier, the book's in four parts, and each of the parts constitutes three chapters. And my editor kind of wanted it that way. He thought it brings balance. And the last chapter just didn't have the oomph, right? So what I had this, I would call it an outside the box thought, which is, okay, let's make the last chapter the afterword. And so then we've got two chapters in the last section. Could those be three chapters? Could those two chapters, I haven't broken into two chapters, what's saying they couldn't be three chapters? And you know what? It actually works better as three chapters. This is totally in the weeds. It will not translate to the audience watching this, but I'm just saying. It was a game-changing moment. And this is the kind of strategic, to anyone else, boring thing that you have to do when you're writing a book that makes a huge difference.
Right. I mean, if you don't structure things in the right way, a book can be easily become hard to follow and unsatisfying to the reader. And you
absolutely.
You might not pick up on that as you are reading it, but you pick up a bad book. You pick up a book that seems to meander, and the chapters are too long, and you're having
the other thing,
following the thread. Like you can tell the difference.
That's the other thing I want to just brag on this book about. I mean, everyone's biased toward what they've written, but I really feel like there's no fat in here. I mean, I read some books and it's just like I'm skimming so many pages because it's stuff that I knew already or stuff that's obvious or just like filler. I don't think there's any filler in here. I mean, I think we've cut out all the fat, basically.
Oh, I would definitely agree with that.
I'm proud of that part. And we still, it's, you know... I mean, I think it's lean and mean.
I want to ask you one last substantive question about the book before we go, though. Because in one sense, if for those of us on the left who might flip through this book, it might seem kind of predictable that you elevate Ronald Reagan in the book, because Reagan has become such a an easy go-to for Republican candidates. You name check Reagan, that's supposed to prove how conservative you are. But you try to do something different with Reagan, in that you are trying to put him in this intellectual canon as the culmination of an intelligent conservatism, not how the left caricatures Reagan as thin, as dumbed down, as, you know, putting on an act. He only got in there because he was a Hollywood actor. He knew how to tell a good joke. The reputation of Reagan as intellectual certainly is not the common perception. So how are you able to sum up, without, you know, giving too much away, how are you able to put him in the pantheon of conservative intellectual giants?
Well, I don't think Reagan was an intellectual, but I think he was incredibly smart. And there was actually a Saturday Night Live skit in the 80s that really hinted at this. It was amazing. It was Phil Hartman as Reagan. You might remember it.
This is the best SNL political sketch of all time.
It's a great one. If you haven't seen it, folks, Google it. But it's amazing. And basically, Reagan, they would bring in, like, Mr. President, you have to meet with this Girl Scout. And he's like, dang it, this is the part of the job I hate. And then she'd come in and be like, well, little girl, if you can sell cookies, we need you up on Capitol Hill, you know, working for us. And then as soon as she was out, he's like, back to business, you know. And he's like, you, these are the countries we're going to sell arms to. These are the countries we're going to funnel, you know. And then he'd be, like, on the phone speaking, like, Arabic or, you know, I mean, he was like a Machiavellian genius.
Right,
and it turns out that, I mean, that's obviously an extreme example, but that version of Reagan is probably more true than we knew. And I basically cite people who reiterate this, who make the same point in the book, whether it's people like Charles Krautheimer, Fred Barnes, people who were, you know, historians. I'm trying to think of the conservative historian whose name escapes me right now, who basically went to the Reagan ranch and sold a ton of books. Bob Novak's book, The Prince of Darkness, he talks about a meeting he had with Reagan where Reagan was citing fairly obscure, you know, economists, and Bob Novak concluded that Reagan was smarter than Bob Novak and Roland Evans, and that that Reagan knew more about economics and philosophy than Bob Novak and Roland Evans knew. Lee Edwards is the historian that escaped me earlier, the conservative historian who recounts a story about going to Reagan's house and being all of these sort of dog-eared books that Reagan had kept. So Reagan was much better read, much smarter than people know. I also talk about how the fact that he was very cosmopolitan. You know, we always hear about Reagan the cowboy, which was an image assiduously cultivated by Reagan's team intentionally. There's a story where Reagan's press secretary wants to release a book. Reagan's press secretary, Terry, I think it's Marlon Fitzwater, wants to release a list of all the books Reagan has read that year. And they want to dispel the notion that all Reagan does is read these Louis L'Amour westerns. Reagan won't allow it. He doesn't want the public to know that he's actually reading things other than these western novels. There's a story in the book, Reagan's running for governor, and there's a reporter that's going to come out to the Reagan ranch to interview him. And Lynn Nofziger, the Reagan aide, makes Reagan's wearing like English riding boots and one of those little helmets or something. And Nofziger makes Reagan go in and change into Western garb and a cowboy hat and come out. So the Reagan team assiduously cultivated, and Reagan participated in cultivating this sort of cowboy image, downplaying his intelligence. I actually argue in the book that had negative repercussions for conservatism. In a way, by reinforcing the notion that it's the stupid party. But I think Reagan, like George W. Bush, Reagan wanted to be misunderestimated, so to speak. The last thing in this chapter deals with is Reagan being cosmopolitan. And Chris Matthews, in his great book Hardball, talks about how Reagan, because he came from Hollywood, because he had been around elites, And other, you know, like gay Americans, for example. You know, the line about Jack Kemp is he showered with more blacks than most than a lot of Republicans have ever met. Reagan had this cosmopolitan background that I think made him a better salesman of conservatism. So I don't know. I think this is a much more interesting, complex version of Reagan, still as a conservative hero. That I think is truthful, but I think it has Reagan as the hero of conservatism that I think he is. But I think it shows a side of him that that not a lot of people know about.
All very interesting, and of course that is just the tip of the iceberg. To fully grasp the entirety of the argument, you need to get the book. You need to pre-order it. Matt Lewis, Too Dumb to Fail. Where are your preferred booksellers?
You know, you can go to local bookstores, which I support. You can go to Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books a Million. It doesn't really matter where, but I would get it now. And you may want to get some copies for friends as well, because I hope it makes a splash. You never know, Bill. You put years into something like this, and sometimes it takes off and sometimes it doesn't. We don't know. We don't know how it's going to go. But I believe in this. I really do believe in it. And so much that that I want people to read this. I want it to make a difference. I think that it could help shape the direction that conservatism goes. And, you know, if you like this show, then you're probably going to, you know, want to get it. So thanks, Bill, for letting me talk about it. And more than that, there were really three people that, you know, there must have been 20 people who read this book and gave me insight and advice, but there were really three people, Christy Spates and David Petruja, who's a historian and author, who has a great book called 1932 that's out right now, that you should get as well, who put in, countless hours. I mean, Bill, not joking here. How many hours do you think you put in to this book alone?
Oh, to your book.
And to my book. How many hours do you think you put into my book in the last year?
I could not even count.
I estimate it's at least 40 hours.
That's probably a fair estimate.
And that's a lot. That is a lot. And your check's in the mail.
Well, hopefully your book tour can come up here.
It's amazing. I'd love to do it. And I have to say, those three people I mentioned did it for free. That doesn't count my editor.
Right.
That my official editor, my publisher, and the people at the publisher who are working on it. And it doesn't count the work that I obviously put into it. Yes, love to get up there, love to get all around the country and talk about the book.
It'll be coming out around New Hampshire. You might want to make a little New Hampshire trip, pass through Northampton. You know, it makes a lot of sense.
How cool would that be? I come up there, I could speak. Is there like a Calvin Coolidge museum I could talk at or something?
Well, I mean, in Northampton, there is the Calvin Coolidge Library, which is a cozy room. But the Forbes Library, which is where the Calvin Coolidge Library is, hosts events. So that might be something worth talking about.
Let's have your people talk to my people. How cool would it be, to go up there and do that? That'd be really neat.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you again. Now let's plug before we go. Let's plug one more time. People need, so you have an article and an interview at Real Clear Politics about Woodrow Wilson.
The video interview is above the article.
And so just go to, I guess, Real Clear Politics. What's it called?
Princeton, Don't Erase Woodrow Wilson's Name.
Okay. Check that out. Pre-order the book. And happy Thanksgiving, everyone. Thank you for watching this show and listening to this show over the years. We really appreciate it. We are thankful for all the blessings we have, including, I'll tell you, Bill, I'm thankful that I get to write and talk about politics for a living. It beats getting a job.
And ditto for me. So I will see you after the holiday. Have a great break.
All right, buddy. Thank you. Thanks. Happy Thanksgiving, everyone.